Earnest and incredibly sleep-inducing reiteration of where I was about 30 minutes ago in my exegesis. And my apologies for that tendency. It's very sad.
I'll allow you guys some time to respond. I think part of, in my opinion, what a lot of, I'll just broadly use the term neo-pagans, though I think a lot of people who are of a skeptical orientation and such, or just an existentialist orientation. In my opinion,
just as
not speaking ex cathedra, the traditions of our ancestors weren't fit for the challenge of late civilization and modernity. If you look at the late Roman Empire, you had these mystery cults and things. You had the gods failed.
The leaders filled the polity with slaves and with a sort of multicultural horde, and of course the thing became unbalanced, and the will of the plebs ceased to find its sort of republican expression, and so on and so forth. So I don't think you can just say, oh, gods did this, or gods failed in that, or the quality of the faith was, this isn't the point.
Also the idea that polytheism and so on can't sustain late civilization seems very bizarre, particularly from my perspective, given that like pretty much the whole of East Asia is doing that right now.
Yeah, be very careful.
If
about
you look
that.
At Japan, they're also sinking into the same nihilism, the same paralysis.
Are we? It doesn't seem so. I mean, if you look at the percentages in terms of mass migration and so on, which country above all right now is resisting this Syrian migration wave, despite the fact that people wanted to put them in there? Japan is being criticized in the Wall Street Journal even today, basically, because Japan is offering aid to refugees without actually inviting any of the refugees to enter the country.
Okay, well, they have not been specifically poisoned by the propaganda, which is sort of explicitly anti-white and has yet to retrofit itself for the East Asian. But as far as the problem of modernity in general, if you look at the birth rates, if you look at the...
This is a point I want to touch on. I don't think the birth rate is a bad thing either. If the birth rate goes down, that's only necessary because pre-1970s, the birth rate in South Korea and in Japan used to be something like 5.0 to 6.0. So there was a massive population boom. All of this is essentially cutting away the remnants of the boom, because when you have a boom, you have to have a bust afterwards. Otherwise, you'd have no space to live in the country.
Okay. Well, I don't think Japan's current demographic situation is sustainable. I do think degeneracy and nihilism are at the root of a lot of Japan's contemporary problems, and will continue.
Well, hold on. When you say degeneracy and nihilism, I suppose you could say plenty of what Japanese culture is would be seen from a monotheistic perspective as being degenerate, and for more than the nihilistic thing. I mean, people have always been accusing Japan of nihilism, even back in the 1600s and the 1500s, when they had what was known as crossroads killings, for example, which is where, you would get a particular sword, and if you thought that the sword was a new and innovative weapon, you would have samurai essentially lying in wait to choose a random person to kill with it to see what would happen. That kind of thing. So obviously, when Westerners saw this kind of thing going on, they would always say, well, that's very nihilistic that you just dispose of life as a military test, for example. But it's the culture survived. It continued on almost despite the fact that it doesn't have the same level of respect for the intrinsic value of life that you see coming from Judeo-Christian traditions. Despite the fact that it lacks this, it still continues to perpetuate itself because it has a sense of itself in the world as a unique block of people that should not be violated from the outside. So it's almost like it's quote-unquote degeneracy is one of its unique selling factors to itself, kind of thing.
Well, I was saying degeneracy in the broader radical traditional sense rather than in the specifically Christian, Orthodox Christian theological moral sense, in which case, like, the sense of honor, the sense of duty, all those things are kind of giving way to a more consumerist and ephemeral and self-worshipping way of life, which I don't think your ancestors would find especially uplifting or noble.
I think that these things have always run parallel to each other, because this is one of the dichotomies that has existed in Japanese society since the time of the rise of Zen, for example. There's the Shinto tradition, which has always been ostentatious and, I guess you could say, quote unquote, consumerist, in the sense that, you know, he has always supported, you know, flaunting wealth and this, that, and the other, you know, saying that you're very blessed because you have, you know, these objects and these things have been given to you, and, you know, you're of a person of particularly high standing or whatever. That kind of status flaunting and so on, which is often referred to as consumerism, was part of what you would say is the Shinto religious culture. But at the same time, it was always mitigated by the opposite side of this, which was manifested ultimately through Zen and its austerity and the stone gardens and, you know, where you would have, you know, things made out of wood and so on and so forth, where everything's supposed to look very humble. And so the culture has always had these two things running in parallel, serving as a balance to each other. And so I think when people say, oh, you know, Japan is becoming too consumerist and this, that, and the other, it's only because they're only looking at one side of the culture and not at the other side, which is simultaneously being sustained. These two things have always run parallel.
I suspect there's sort of an expatriate's optimism about the Japanese culture and its trajectory. Time will tell. I don't believe that the Shinto tradition and the Buddhist influence and stuff, I don't believe Japan's prepared to transition from its traditional martial culture into late degenerate modernity, and I believe it has some huge challenges ahead of itself, and I think Christianity is that answer to the rebirth of a civilization. And in the Japanese context, it would be one of baptizing Japanese tradition, not of replacing Japanese tradition, as you would imagine.
We had to resist that before, early. Though, of course. We had to resist that before because people have already tried to bring Christianity to Japan the first time, and it was Hideyoshi Toyotomi who had to actually repel it at that time.
Kumiko, can I remind you of something that we were curious about?
I see your message. I'm about to ask that question as well. I wanted to. You personally, Matt, having a recent article you wrote about this pro-life business, which is where I was going with. I mentioned sanctity of life before. I was talking about crossroads killing, but I want to lead that in. So this sanctity of life thing, which came from Christianity, very largely. You actually said that you would actually put your pro-life position above the existence of European peoples. I found that incredible when I read that. Were you actually serious when you said that?
Yes, though I think the conclusions people draw from that are incorrect. My belief is faith, family, and folk in that order. And the abortion position runs through both faith and family. I mean, the problem is that people are saying, well, abortion's a good thing because it mainly, in our multicultural society, it mainly affects minorities. And what I'm saying is that, obviously, I'm for separating our communities to where this wouldn't even be a factor. I would be certainly opposed to abortion. I'm just opposed to abortion regardless of political context. I'm not in any way saying that I'm against the welfare of my people. I'm just saying that aborting the innocent children of the enemy is not an acceptable tactic in my faith tradition.
Okay. If you're against aborting, is it because you're against aborting any children at all? Even if they're you just said it, right? Even if they're the enemy, you said you'd abort them. Well, are you against arbitrarily killing them then?
I'm not a strict ideological pacifist. One would have to look to the Christian doctrines of just war. There is a time for war, and if it's a case of total war, then you have to respond with total war. Defending the faith requires defending the people of the faith, and in an absolute war context.
I want to get to the underpinning here, though, because the pro-life position seems to imply that there is intrinsic value in every human being. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Where theologically do you get that idea from?
What would
cause you to not just dispose of people if they're in the way, to put it as bluntly as possible?
I forget the exact scriptural thing, but before I placed you in the womb, I knew you. Christianity has a incredibly long tradition which runs through scripture and through our later traditions of being opposed to abortion. I don't have, I like I said, I'm not as well prepared as you. I didn't know directly, but exactly how my faith got to that point. I should be better prepared for that. But all I know is that each human life is precious until it condemns itself with its own behavior. And the slaughter of an innocent child is not a Christian behavior.
Okay. What if it occurs within acceptable parameters that have been defined by the society? If the idea of what is acceptable or unacceptable is constructed in society socially, then why would it be wrong if everyone were to come out and say that it is right, for example?
Well, the whole point of having a faith is you believe that there is this there is a God and there is His law and His and obedience to Him, which transcends everything else, including your own life.
Okay.
So,
I'm going to interject with another question then, as a comparison, because obviously you know I'm going to go to warfare now. If, for example, do you remember when Anwar al-Awlaki was hit with a drone strike from a UCAV?
Vaguely.
Do you remember that time? Right. And who was in his house with him at the time? One of his children, was it not?
Yeah.
From my memory. Exactly. So in that situation, would you say that it was wrong to have put the drone strike on him knowing that young people were near him? Or would you say that it was within acceptable parameters? Obviously, my position is the latter, that it was within the acceptable parameters. If you put the drone strike on him and he happens to have children there, guess whose fault that is? That's not our fault. That's his fault.
Well, I mean, in war, and that's why one should be very careful about instigating war, in war, innocents are going to be collateral damage in the way. And I do think there is, in just war and Christian doctrine, there is a distinction between the willful targeting of innocents, which abortion most certainly is, and calculated attacks on the enemy, which may or may not hurt innocent people, which, I mean, Christian military tradition is entirely cognizant of that. And obviously, if you take that to its absurd conclusion, you couldn't really defend yourself. You would reduce yourself to an absolute pacifist, because all the enemy would have to do is throw a child in the way.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
and that's partly why they do what they do as well. Because sometimes what they'll do is they'll try to put themselves into situations where they can say, oh, there's a school in front of us and this, that, and the other. Of course, quite fortunately, the precision of weapons has reached a stage where they can't just hide behind a school, for example, and expect not to be hit, because it is possible to hit them and not damage the school if you're lucky. So,
I think that's a great development when it works out. It doesn't always. War is sloppy. But I think that's morally distinct from a willful, deliberate decision to slaughter your child.
But it does seem that a choice is still being made, in the sense that if you have a woman who is pregnant and another woman who is pregnant, so two women who are pregnant, and one of them chooses to abort and the other one does not, then it means it is quite similar, in the sense that you're preferring one over the other. As in, one was simply got through the validation and the other one did not get through the validation, because it's still a choice. For example, the person pressing the button on the drone strike is still making a choice as to whether they're going to actually accept the collateral or not. The choice to accept collateral in certain circumstances shows that there are constructs in which people will decide, well, it's okay to kill another human being in the pursuit of some other goal. Similarly with abortion, people are saying that it's okay to kill in the pursuit of the strengthening of a particular racial group. For example, if you take South Korea as an example, South Korea had an incredibly ballooning population around 1974 or so, and they came to the conclusion that the only way to get more wealth into the hands of less people would be if they essentially went on a drive for birth control and abortion. And this thing was promoted throughout the society by Park Chung-hee. And, you know, you could say that from the Christian perspective, you would say that, you know, many South Korean babies were culled or something to that extent. But what was the outcome of this? The final outcome, consequentially, was that South Korea's wealth increased rapidly along with their development. So would you not say that it was worth it in that case?
it was not worth it. And like I said, the entire point of having a faith is you when you have a law, you abide by it regardless of the consequences. Now, we have, as an Orthodox Christian, we have this rich and evolved tradition guided by the church fathers and by sacred scripture and by experience and by our own intuitive reason as well. All of these things are part of this coherent whole, which arrives at a broad synthesis on what is Orthodox and what is not Orthodox. So, you know, we believe that it's acceptable to engage in war in which there's a potential for the loss of innocent human life in certain circumstances. And we believe that condoning abortion is always wrong.
Okay. I have one other question as well. I know you did say that we were about to be done, but there is still one more left. That is the issue of sexual repression. I see that in an article you guys had written, I think the author is you in this one as well, you were talking about the issue of the mass migration wave, which has been brought on by Angela Merkel and company, sweeping over Western Europe at the moment. One of the places of entry is Italy, and of course, obviously, along the routes leading into Europe from there. And I think there was an image or an article that was something to do with Muslims on a beach. Do you recall what I'm talking about? Something about Muslims on a beach, and they were criticizing French women. That was it. So they were criticizing French women about the style of dress which they were wearing on the beach. And one of you, I'm pretty sure it was you, wrote that you were at a quandary. Was that the word you used? I don't have it in front of me, so I'm recalling from memory. You were at a quandary over who to be madder at because of the fact that you were saying that you half agreed with the Muslims in their criticism of French women. Isn't that what that was? Daniel was saying that was Heimbach. Daniel was saying it's Heimbach who said this.
We do believe in traditional gender roles and in encouraging chastity and sexual restraint. So even if I wasn't guilty of the particular comment you're talking about, I can certainly take ownership of it, as I believe that in a lot of critical ways, contemporary Muslims are less degenerate than contemporary Westerners.
Oh. And, okay, well, isn't this what I talked about? I talked earlier about quote unquote degeneracy being almost like a unique selling factor. Isn't this degeneracy which you speak of one of the defining factors of a difference between Western Europeans and essentially the invading, I mean, let's frankly call it what it is, an invasion of Islamic people? Isn't that one of the defining things that you rally people with, where you should be able to come out and say, you can be on a beach and wear whatever you want because you're in Western Europe. You can't have these people coming from outside into the country telling you what to do now.
Okay.
Surely it would have been better to take that side than to have been found, vacillating between the two.
Well, we are for tribe and tradition. We are trad youth, not white youth. And you see there are points like with this one where the Jews and Freemasons have an opportunity that we do not. And you see them leveraging that with the sort of the Zionist identitarian, quasi-identitarian cultural projects like the EDL or the New National Front and stuff, where they essentially use our degeneracy as like, don't let these religious people come in and tell you to stop having gay sex. If you want to keep on like having gay orgies, you need to oppose immigration. And our position
isn't that a good tactic though? Not to give any credit to the Jews for this, but isn't that a good tactic when it comes from people who are not the Jews, for example? although I haven't seen that many Jews doing this though. When was the last time you saw the Jews telling you that it's a good idea to be a nationalist? I don't think that's happened.
Well, you do see with like Geert Wilders, who's very closely aligned with a lot of Jewish interests and stuff. So not the Jews directly necessarily, but I do think there is a lot of Jewish money and Jewish influence going into some of these kosher nationalist projects that you're seeing in Western Europe. It's an excellent tactic when it works. But like I said, I am an Orthodox Christian with a set of laws I have to abide by in my hands.
Also, how do
I cannot endorse gay orgy.
Since I was only talking about women on a beach in this particular case. So,
yes.
For example, what were they doing wrong that would make them degenerate in this case because they have the temerity to wear a swimsuit?
Okay, I don't remember the exact context. My position is that cultural mores that the Christian tradition has to adapt to cultural mores of modesty, and modesty varies from one civilization to another. Like, if you were to take the New Guineans, you wouldn't necessarily force them to stop wearing their penis gourds and such. You'd have to figure out what modesty is in their context and have an organic, syncretic understanding of modesty and virtue within their aboriginal tradition. And to some extent, the aboriginal French, what comprises a modest swimsuit, they're not really my country. Even within a country that varies, like I'm from the Midwest,
true.
And a lot of men on the coasts will wear like these thong, I don't even like Speedo style swimsuits that just like on a visceral level, I'm just like, ugh, that seems really degenerate and gay to me. But maybe it's not for them. So, I mean, to some extent, like the whole thing's negated by I have no standing to discern what's modest or immodest in French culture.
Okay.
I guess ultimately, like, I would have to step back from that and just whatever the French within their Catholic tradition, whatever they would discern to be appropriate swimwear, I would respect.
Okay, well, another question then. I know, I'm sorry, I'm adding on more. you've placed gay next to degenerate, for example. What are your views on homosexuality? Obviously, I tried to look to find it before I asked you this question, but it was kind of murky, so I'm actually not sure what you're going to say.
Okay. As far as homosexuality, it's explicitly prohibited in the Christian tradition. And I believe, especially now as it's manifesting as an actual subculture and identity and with a force that in the Christian tradition beckons back to Sodom and Gomorrah. When you say like absolute degeneracy, my first thought would be a gay orgy. it's certainly, I mean, how opposed am I to homosexuality? I consider it wrong and bad, and one shouldn't do it. On another hand, we are a degenerate society, and I myself carry a certain degree of degeneracy. And in the Christian tradition, it's understood that we're all sinners. So in a lot of ways, I'm actually more tolerant of homosexuals than a lot of American Christians would be, because I really hate the sin and not the sinner. And like, I think like Jack Donovan and several other homosexual or presumptively homosexual people within our circles do excellent
work.
That's
precisely why I asked the question, yes.
Okay, and I do not obstruct their work. I don't hear coming up with the MPI. There's been a lot of objection to Jack Donovan speaking. Now, if he were speaking at MPI advocating homosexuality, that would be something I would object to. But if he just happens to be that, and he's advocating for these generally noble things, which I believe he is, I believe there's a lot in the revival of masculinity. I think there's a lot of good work and good to be gained from his ideas. I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to drum him out of the movement, lest I drum divorced people out of the movement, and then what am I going to do with myself? I mean, if you know, what if every time I tried to go up somewhere, they're like, you've been divorced, get out of here, you adulterer, I'm very much against divorce. In fact, I'd quibble that like my divorce was not welcomed by me or whatever. I'd like to make a distinction there. But the bottom line is that I'm not perfect. And I, you know, to fight degeneracy, it has to be sort of an Isle of Misfit Goys, a sort of a bunch of people who have a past, And that would go to women who've been promiscuous or whatever. You know, from this moment forward, let's try to build each other up. Let's not just excommunicate everybody because they have a past or because there's some part that they're not ready to work on yet or whatever. This has to be an organic thing, and it's going to be a long road. And I think some of these more rigid, like, there's nothing magical about being gay that makes it especially more evil than all of the rest of Christian sins. I think lacking in humility is degenerate. I do it every day, but I'm working on it. And unless I were giving a conference on in which I said that we must stop being humble, I would hope I would not be drummed out of the movement for lacking in humility.
Okay, well, that brings me to another question. I know you're creating more questions as you go along. Isn't this all kind of guilt-based? Where, for example, on the divorce issue, for example, obviously, I mean, nobody's into calling because I don't know the details, but, you know, you would think that most of the time that people would be not sad about divorce in the sense that, you know, usually it's getting out of a situation that you tied yourself to that you've realized that you shouldn't have done. So okay, why should a person have some kind of guilt about this in the first place for it to become an issue that could be an obstruction? Like, if it wouldn't be obstruction if there were no guilt about it at all anyway.
Okay, well, that actually has that can be explained while leaving Christianity entirely aside. I made an oath, and as a radical traditionalist, when one makes an oath, regardless of what faith one has, a man is only as good as his oaths, as his honor. The Roman soldier in Pompeii who stood at his post as Vesuvius erupted around him, I see that as a noble character to emulate, whereas maybe you would be scrambling down the mountain. And I respect that. But, you know, like I said, my radical traditionalist principles are more important to me and transcend everything I do, including my racial advocacy. And, you know, I'm not. There are definitely people who make their race their religion, whose loyalty to the white race or whatever transcends everything else. I'm not that guy. I would argue that my list of achievements and my dedication put me at the forefront of people who've been fighting for our race. But if you actually, you know, ask me, like, is your race your most important thing to you? I would say no. I think I have a calling of fighting for my tribe, but I think my faith and my radical traditionalist principles fuel that and empower me to be more effective than a lot of these people who, you know, I don't get it when these people say that their race is their religion. They certainly don't act like it in their daily lives, in my opinion, as far as what they're willing to sacrifice for it, how doggedly they fight for it. You know,
take this out because it's against the rule of my participation, if you must, but I'm really curious to ask one question if I can. I don't hear a lot of criticism of the process that would go into an African population explosion. Isn't that result of irresponsible sex? And it seems as if there's a relativistic thing going on here where their heterosexual irresponsibility with regard to sex is actually much more destructive even than gay sex. At least gay sex isn't producing children. Now, I don't like homosexuality, and I'm not an admirer of it. But I just wonder why such a big deal is made of that when, you know, this irresponsible heterosexual sex is so much more destructive. And is it hands off with regard to Africa, because that's where the real population explosion is coming from.
Yeah, that was okay. The next question I was going to ask. That was actually the next question I was going to ask. So, yes,
okay.
Go ahead, Matt.
I'm glad you brought up the heterosexual sexual degeneracy, because, I mean, that's a major problem, too. And my record's not spotless on that either. So, and that's one of the reasons why, like, the witch hunt against Jack Donovan, I can't really be at the forefront of, because I don't stand, you know, can't cast a stone on that. That being said, as far as like with Africa, the vision for Africa is a complete Christian and traditional solution is commensurate with the local customs. And if the West would keep hands off, and I mean both the secular and the Christian evangelical West, Africa is actually arriving at Christian traditional solutions to these problems. Contrary to popular belief, Africa's population boom is actually gradually coming into balance. It's going to take several decades. As far as like with the AIDS pandemic in Africa, there's been a huge amount of like a change of behavior. And like, for example, like the taboo against homosexuality in Africa is very necessary. And very strict, and I don't object to them having like laws where you kill the homosexual, because in their context, degenerate sexual behavior is so dangerous with the epidemic that they're struggling with, that is a necessary show of force. Now, is killing the innocent unborn a necessary show of force? I guess even if that were the only solution, I guess I would just have to choke on all the extra Africans, but I don't think it is. I don't think abortion is the solution to Africa's population problems. I think you're seeing Africa within its African context and relative to Africans' abilities. Africa is doing fantastic. Africa's economy is growing, its populations are stabilizing, they're adapting the technologies. Nobody is seriously even proposing that abortion be used as a solution to the African problem.
Well, I thought that the founder of Planned Parenthood held that position.
I guess Margaret Sanger.
Margaret Sanger is one of the big proponents of that. Go on.
And I'm opposed to that. I think
it's only one thing. What I was more concerned about is that you've got this universalistic view of Christianity that suddenly becomes relativistic and adjusted to the culture for them, and has nothing to say about their irresponsible behavior that leads to that's leading to this population explosion that becomes the rest of the world's problem somehow.
We make it our problem, and what opponents of Christian universalism?
I don't. But the Catholic Church.
I don't either. Yeah, and the Catholic Church does, and a lot of secular organizations do too. Of course, it's certainly not limited to Christian charities, but I mean, ultimately, it's the word for it is pluriversalism. I'm not being relativistic. I'm not self-contradicting when I say it's both universal and particular. Okay, the reductio ad absurdum of this sort of like, well, universalism implies a dissolution of all nations. It also implies a dissolution of all identities, of all gender roles, of all familial roles. It implies a dissolution of patriarchy. It implies a dissolution of the family into one big, silly, buy the world a Coke global sing-along, which is just so incommensurate with Christian tradition as it's understood with the sacred texts and everything like that. I mean, believing that Christianity is a universal faith does not in any way, like when the Orthodox went into Alaska among the natives, they didn't force them to wear pants. They didn't cut down their totem poles or anything. They found where they're at and
tried to baptize them into the religion, right?
Yes, they baptized the entire nations.
Exactly, but isn't that culturally destructive in and of itself that they would presume that they should do that?
Well, the part of their culture
is it's not just an overlay. It's just not just an overlay. It fundamentally changes the way that people behave once it's been imposed onto them.
That seems to be extremely
dangerous.
God created them to be baptized, and I don't think it is dangerous. I think if you look the world over, when Christian evangelism is done right, it strengthens the cultures, it strengthens the identities, and it gives them the grounding they need, like with the Ethiopians, with the Ethiopian Orthodoxy. The Ethiopians are tremendously African. They have this very rich history, which is integrally African. And that's not contradicted by, and the Ethiopian people have not been harmed by Christianity. They've been armed and undergirded by it. And it's Ethiopian Christianity is a beautiful thing.
Well, that's from closer to the position of origin than Alaska, for example. But obviously, you know, people can say, you know, Ethiopia is quite close to the Levant, relatively speaking, whereas Alaska is completely out in a different different area, different population group. Like, the gulf between these people is massive.
Well, and but they
just to say that you end up with people in Alaska trying to adopt an Abrahamic religion out of the Levant. It's not designed for them. It's not adapted to them. It didn't evolve with them.
Well, that's where you've got to decouple universal Christianity from the particular adaptations. I think a lot of the problem with the West is we try to impose our Christianity on people rather than trying to baptize their entire nations. That's what we got, and that's why we have Easter. That's why we have Christmas. That's why we have Halloween. That's why it's hard to tell where Christianity begins and our ancient folk traditions end, is because our nations were baptized. We weren't the victims of a total cultural imperialism.
Had they come out immediately and simply just struck down your older and pre-existing culture and replaced it with their own, there would have been mass resistance, right? Or there would have been at least more of a mass resistance than there was.
Okay, I mean,
what you call baptizing entire nation seems to me to be like a euphemism for co-opting, where you co-opt elements of the old religion and hope that no one notices that you've fundamentally changed the content.
Well, I'm being quite explicit about what I'm advocating for here, because you asked explicitly. I mean, ultimately, imposing Christianity on other nations is not something we're in a position to do for several decades from now. And in fact, like with our work with like the Shia Muslims and our support of Assad, we in Japan, like our goal is to defend their identity and traditions. I mean, at some point down the road, we would like to baptize them into the one true religion as Orthodox. I mean, I don't know what you want from me here. I think it's the one true faith. I think salvation comes through him. And that's what, you know, every actual Christian believes. Any Christian who doesn't insist that we should try to baptize the world isn't actually a Christian, because he's saying that like God is optional and therefore, you know, he's not omnipotent, and that, you know, at that point you're a heretic and you're just a cultural Christian.
Indeed, but then you can understand from our perspective then that we are forced into conflict with you then, because no one can say that it's unreasonable that we would resist this then, if we have, you know, entrenched positions that we're trying to defend and Christians are intended to baptize, for example, since you brought up Japan, baptized Japan, and I suppose you'd say South Korea, the rest of Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth, into Orthodoxy. If they fight back, then no one should be able to say that it's unreasonable that conflict has arisen from this.
Okay, well, that's where matters of strategy come in. I mean, we do have that imperative, but we also have to look at the big picture of where things are at geopolitically. And at this hour, at this moment, all of the enemies of the Jewish and multinational corporate Hydra, we're all threatened by the same global force and must unite and work together. So I absolutely say that we are in no position to be trying to invade and force the Japanese to be baptized. Not that I even think that it should be done by force when it should be done by persuasion. I think it should be done in a way that's respectful of Japanese tradition and culture. But at this point, I would not propose that because it would be an impediment. So
it's kind of like a deferred conflict then, because it would have to come up later, in the sense that you're saying, okay, after we've dealt with the issue of liberal capitalism, then you would essentially reopen that whole Pandora's box of conflict then.
Absolutely. And let me state this very clearly. We are not attacking the neo-pagans. We're not attacking the Muslims. We're not attacking the Japanese Shintoists. We are trying to build a friendly global alliance of identities and traditions against the Jewish and globalist forces out to destroy us all. if you all, because we do have this larger global mission to baptize the world in the distant future, if you guys would prefer to fight that internecine battle now and let the Jews and the corporations defeat us both while we're attacking each other, then that's your prerogative. But I'm not going to do that. I haven't done that. Our Trad Youth mission is very clearly stated that we're not going to do that. Occasionally, we get a little wound up with our Christian rhetoric from time to time, and I do apologize for that. But at the end of the day, you know, all of our traditions, including yours, are threatened by the global Jewish community and by global capitalism. If we don't hang together, we'll hang separately. And I mean, you're absolutely right that at some point we would like to defeat people like yourself who are anti-Christians. But you get to decide whether how you want to prioritize that. I know how I'm prioritizing this struggle. I know where my strategy's at. And ultimately, if you want to keep attacking Christians while we're both being threatened by this much larger common enemy, then that's your prerogative.
Well, I mean, it depends on whether you're capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time. I mean, from my perspective, I might be able to say that I can walk and chew the gum at the same time. I don't know whether you'd be able to, though.
No, it's not. It's about if you're fighting us, you're weakening us against our common enemy, okay? If you'd like to take on all of your enemies at the same time,
Well, you'd use different tactics. You would use different tactics. So I'm not saying that you should suicidally engage in opening multiple fronts at the same time, but sometimes you have no choice, because in the case of Christianity and Islam, because of course I group these together as a common threat on that front, you have to be on your guard against those two or three, because if you group Judaism too, so essentially all three Abrahamic religions, you have to be on guard against these three traditions at the same time as simultaneously dealing with the erosion that's coming from liberal capitalism. It's unfortunate that it has turned out that way, and it's unfortunate that we're not able to have this fight in the cleanest way possible, because, you know, in my view, the cleanest way possible would be if there were no Abrahamic religions to be dealt with, and we can just face off against liberal capitalism directly. Unfortunately, history has not dealt us that hand, and so we're trapped in this unfortunate situation. It would have been nice if history had dealt us this hand, but they didn't.
Okay. Okay. Well, the traditionalist Christian faction is attempting to solve this problem first. If you refuse that prioritization, I think that's the detriment of us all.
Well, okay, why is it that you guys didn't just follow our way instead? Because you're saying that, you know, all of us should essentially accommodate you at this point. Why shouldn't it have been the other way around?
Given that you guys are the
minority anyway.
Our mission statement is very clear on this, that we will accommodate the other faith tradition, and we've demonstrated that. I mean, we're the only group that went out on the street protesting in support of Assad, a pious Muslim.
But that's another Abrahamic religion. I didn't see you guys doing the same thing with regards to when liberal capitalists were trying to convince Burma that they should accommodate Muslims in Arakan province, for example, which the West has been doing consistently over and over again, saying that these people should tolerate Muslims in Arakan province. Burma is Buddhist land. And so how come no one came up with that one? Because that one wasn't an Abrahamic religion, though, right?
No, that honestly did not have, I wasn't even aware of that situation. We were definitely for identities and traditions in a broad sense. And I mean, I certainly considered myself an ally of Jonathan Bowden when we spoke, and it was understood as such. In my identitarian work, I'm definitely, as you said, in the minority as an authentic Christian. You have a lot of people in our circles who pretend to be Christian because they're playing a not so clever attempt to cleverly disguise themselves as a majority religion, which Christianity
exactly.
is not anymore.
It's not, exactly.
And I agree with you 100% that, you know, this idea that let's just be Christian, pretend to be Christian because that rocks the boat the least. Christianity is dying in the West, and we totally get that. We see ourselves as insurgents, and I think a lot of people, they try to nod and wink at us, like, yeah, you're Christian, yeah, because that's the ticket. No, that's my ticket to heaven. we are true believers, but at the same time, We also are willing, as Christians have done all throughout history, of allying ourselves with and working with and intelligently, strategically finding common ground against a more powerful and more dangerous common enemy.
Okay, regarding the mass
migration, we don't privilege Muslims over any other faith tradition, and we certainly don't privilege Jews.
Okay, well, speaking of demography, then, I've heard some interesting comments coming from people regarding this African population explosion, which Daniel had been talking about earlier. But I want to talk about it in a slightly different context, which is the context of Africans flowing into Europe. Africans entering Europe seem to be, of course, more Christian than the European population itself. So some people have been floating the idea that what's actually happened to Christianity is that it's returning to Africa. By returning, they're putting this in quotation marks, of course. But they're saying, you know, it's going back to Africa. So there is going to come a point in the future in which there will be essentially more African Christians than there are even nominal European Christians. What happens in that situation? Like, is there not a danger of a demographic slide that could occur where you end up having to pander to these people because they profess the same faith as you?
Okay, well, I mean, to even though they some are the extent, migrants. As an Orthodox Christian, that's our ecclesiastical structure is with the bishops and such. We're not as inclined as the Catholics or the Protestant evangelicals towards that sort of global drift. The Pope is in many ways is sort of the emperor, the Pontifex Maximus of the entire church, and himself identifying with the third world, the Latin third world. Not properly Latin for all of you Spaniards and Italians out there. But he's definitely sort of identifies with the third world, and that's tremendously dangerous, and that's where I think that sort of universalist Christianity is toxic, is dangerous. And yeah, the whole thing sort of operates as a global democracy where as Christianity reaches 49% white, as it's rapidly doing, it'll intrinsically become tribally anti-white. And that's a terrible, despicable problem. I think in the Orthodox tradition, we have the solution to that. But yeah, I fully agree that in the West right now, Christianity has become cuckolded and distorted into this enemy of our folk. That wants to see us die and actually considers it a heresy to want your people to continue existing. And that's boggling from a Christian historical perspective, that Christianity has been so perverted that it's a formal heresy subject to excommunication to simply say, I want my people to continue existing and thriving in their traditional homelands.
Well, there's another.
To the extent that you're angry at Christianity for that, I am too. it's
there was also even an instance of this where it overlaps with the cultural issue that you talked about earlier, where the Archbishop of Canterbury in the United Kingdom, so you'd be the head of the Church of England, well, the head of the Church of England under the Queen, obviously, but you know what I mean. The leader of the Church of England being asked on, I think it was, I can't remember which radio show it was. I'll put it in the comments or something, but he was asked on a particular radio show what his view was. It was a liberal who was putting this question to him, of course, asking him a question on why hasn't the Church of England taken a stronger stance on the issue of homosexuality, for example? And by stronger, of course, from the liberal perspective, they meant stronger as in not saying bad things about it. And the response of the Archbishop was that he has to take into account now the fact that most of the people in the Church of England are non-white and not living in the West, and that therefore he cannot actually support homosexuality given that his primary population that he's pandering to is actually inside Africa. And the host asked him this question, was absolutely stunned by this, because obviously he hadn't prepared ahead of time for this question, but, you know, he was stunned by that, and I was just like, why would you not find that to be obvious?
Well, the Church of England was supposed to be for the English, and supposed to be stewards of their flock, as a shepherds protecting their flock. And increasingly, they're inviting the world's wolves to feast on their traditional flock, and they've become you know, like the Archbishop of Canterbury. You know, there's complexity here, because on the same token, like African Christians in Africa are actually, in many ways, beacons of opposing.
More true to the precisely that the Christians would even be able to argue that technically the African Christians were more quote unquote true to Christianity than the host asking the Archbishop what he should do. Because of the fact that, obviously, in Christianity, they say that homosexuality is prohibited. The black Christians in Africa also believe it's prohibited, whereas white Christians in the United Kingdom seem to be very wishy-washy on that particular issue because they don't actually believe that, which is why he was being asked that question on the radio show in the first place, being asked why doesn't he pander to his own constituency instead of to the black ones.
Right.
And so, yeah, that is two levels of complexity, both demographic and on social issues. He's trapped in a tangle there.
Right. Well, in the Christian, in the Orthodox tradition, now Ethiopian Orthodox is technically not in communion with the Eastern Orthodoxy, but it's close enough for this metaphor. We would be friends with and allies with those African Christians. And, of course, we wouldn't allow them into our homelands. Okay? We wouldn't have that conflation of...
Hold on, let me pause you there, actually. This is different from what is presently happening in Germany, for example, among Lutherans and the others. There's this apparently an ancient church tradition called sanctuary, which is where if they claim that they're a refugee, then they can be let in because of the fact that the church is supposed to protect them. Do you guys have that belief in Orthodoxy as well? Because it's presently working to great effect in Germany, because some people who are supposed to be deported are actually being sheltered by church ministers as we speak.
Okay, well, I mean, in that case, you come back to how there's a perversion of tradition, and I absolutely would stand for dragging each and every one of those false refugees out of their churches with guns to defend the German homeland from what's clearly an invasion. They pass through multiple nations to get there. Even the Syrian ones, who perhaps are arguably refugees, the minute they left Turkey... Or Lebanon or Jordan or any of the countries that were harboring them without war, the minute they left those countries, they were no longer refugees. They were economic migrants, and their current behavior is quite clear that they're invaders. And
correct.
There comes a point where the people, if you have churches and clergy who are actively betraying the people, the nation, who are serving their flock up to wolves, then there's an obligation to stop them. Okay, and that's what should be happening. Though, I mean, in Germany, actually Christian? How much of that's actually just the secular degenerate liberalism? It's certainly complicated as to how much Christian doctrine can be blamed for.
Well, in Orthodoxy, does the tradition of sanctuary exist?
Yes.
Okay. So, why would it not be utilized to that effect? Because I'm pretty sure it would have been used to that effect previously, perhaps not as explicitly as this. But what would prevent it from being adapted to this purpose now?
Intention is key here. if you're offering sanctuary to those in need in a sustainable way, then it's noble and aligned with Christian tradition. If you're doing a pharisaical juggling of the law to excuse and allow a hostile invasion of a foreign nation, then it's not traditional. It's not Christian. That's where a single ounce of common sense goes a long way.
Okay, talking about Syria and northern Iraq then, and we're talking about like actual migrants versus refugees. Actual migrants in this case would be largely Sunni Muslims, 78% of which are male, right? We agree that that's what's happening. Sunni Muslims, 78% of which are male, flowing into Europe, right?
Yes.
And then, of course, you have the real refugees who have not actually gotten out of there, because there are about 200,000 or is it 300,000 Yazidis who are still stuck essentially inside of northern Iraq that liberals and I suppose the entire North Atlantic has essentially just ignored.
Right.
Like, they've been forgotten about, and they're the actual people who are being preyed upon by ISIL because of the fact that obviously you know, Yazidis worship the peacock angel, and of course, you know, from the ISO perspective, the peacock angel is in fact Lucifer, and, you know, nobody wants to touch these people, no one has anything to do with them. What is your position on that? If there was someone to be rescued, would you say that Europe should have rescued the Yazidi? Of course, my position is yes on this. Is yours the same?
I would actually say yes, too. I don't think that bringing them here is the way to rescue them. I do think that prohibiting genocide of peoples, even peoples of different religious faiths, is consistent with Christian principle and doctrine. And I my sympathies would be with the Yazidis, even if their peacock does turn out to be Satan or whatever. I mean, I don't, yeah, what a, over ISIS, but yeah.
Okay.
Ultimately, we need Middle Eastern solutions to Middle Eastern problems.
That much I agree on as well. I was very, very upset about the fact that we have not had fast enough action in Iraq, because if someone had intervened earlier, none of this would be happening at this moment. All these people were putting up their hands saying, oh, we're war weary, we can't go back there again. Like, I mean, why not? This would not be happening now if people had gone back there again. Rather than dealing with how we can hide them inside of Europe and so on, we'd instead be protecting their actual territory inside their land. Perhaps none of this would be happening. ISIL could have been knocked down probably by two or three combat brigades at the beginning of this. What was the reason for why it didn't happen?
I mean, even if we were to completely stomp ISIS, that wouldn't remove the larger problem of Sunni identity and national struggle. In the Middle East, that
in
was
Western
kind of
Iraq,
kicked off by there. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, it was kicked off by the Iraq War. You know, by our disastrous foreign policy. And I mean, I think perhaps a tripartition of Iraq immediately after the war,
very well said,
would have
prevented
much
of this from happening.
Yeah, but I mean, America,
because Nuri al-Maliki was really just outraging them because of his ridiculous rule from Eastern Iraq, essentially. And his overshadowing by Iran, it inflamed Sunni identitarian behavior, which snowballed into this.
Okay, a lot of people wish to vilify ISIS, most especially ISIS themselves in a lot of their propaganda and stuff. But a lot of these things really do just boil down to discrete tribal interests and tribal conflicts, and the Sunni feeling that they've sort of been left behind in many ways after the Iraq War and the Shia domination of Iraq. And, you know, I don't have all the answers to that. I think a tripartition of Iraq would have certainly been a more sustainable arrangement than the current one, but that's neither here nor there, and my final interests lie with my own people.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. Okay, Matt, thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you very much.
Right.
All the best.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yep, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, everybody.